From Tennessee to Texas, Nebraska to North Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Congress is attempting to assert its authority in foreign affairs and spending, but it is eager to give away power to deep state bureaucrats to impose regulations. Noah Wall of FreedomWorks is here to explain. The White House is attempting to get the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement over the finish line. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Social Security trustees this past week warned that the system will become insolvent in 16 years and unable to pay full benefits unless changes are made. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And the skyrocketing cost of higher education has resulted in massive student debt. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says colleges and universities must change how they do business. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In high-profile showdowns with the president, Congress has attempted to assert its constitutional authority over border wall spending and the ongoing U.S. involvement in Yemen. But the legislative branch is more than willing to let the deep state make often unpopular regulations. Here to sort through this is Noah Wall. Noah is Vice President of Advocacy at FreedomWorks. Noah, welcome to American Radio Journal. Noah, as we look at Congress and the fact that there is a growing tension between the legislative and executive branches in a number of areas, let's talk specifically about a couple of them today. And one that was in the news over the last couple of weeks involves Yemen and U.S. military activity there. Can you explain to us, first of all, what is taking place in Yemen and what was Congress attempting to achieve in a resolution related to that conflict?
What's going on in Yemen is there's a civil war that's been going on since 2014, 2015, and the United States is essentially in the middle of it, supporting Saudi Arabia's efforts. We're not taking a direct combat role so much as supporting the bombing raids that the Saudi Arabia government is involved in. I believe there's drone strikes going on, things of that nature. And what Congress is initiated with this resolution is a hope to try and scale back our military involvement in the region. And I think that what Congress is more broadly trying to do is reassert a little bit of its authority per the Constitution. You know, the Congress has a role in declaring war and declaring the use of military force. And I think that they've done a horrible thing by really abdicating that responsibility. And I think this is an attempt by members of Congress to try and reassert that authority a little bit.
As a result of that, Congress passed a resolution. The president didn't quite agree, did he?
No, it's interesting. It's one of those things. The president's instinct on this is less war, less foreign intervention. But I think that there's a lot of inertia, and I think there's a lot of people in the Pentagon and the State Department who try and come up with reasons why not to change current policy. And I think ultimately this is Yemen is Obama's war, and I think that the president, I do believe he will withdraw us from Yemen. He doesn't need a congressional resolution to do that. He can do that on his own. But I think ultimately what's going on here is a fight between the deep state that loves perpetual war and then Trump, ultimately, who I think does want to scale us back. But I think he also wants to be responsible about it, which is fair.
Another area where we have seen congressional authority, and in this case, congressional authority over the public treasury, over the pocketbook, if you will, come into conflict with the president. No, it was the recent dispute between Congress and the president over funding for the border wall, and even some Republicans in the U.S. Senate who very much agree that we need a border wall did not go along with the president on that issue. Is this maybe a more clear-cut area where Congress should be taking a stand, the border wall itself and the reasons for it aside?
Yeah, I think that what Congress did on that front, this is all goes back to, I believe, the 2006 authorization for a border wall. Congress authorized it, but didn't provide funds for it. And I think what the Trump administration tried to say, okay, well, we'll use discretionary funds from elsewhere, and Congress kind of stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. And I think that what this ultimately is, well, there's a number of different things. I think congressional Republicans are trying to be responsible and trying to keep the president in check. And that is all, you know, we have separation of powers for a reason. And I think that it's always good when you have Congress try and hold the executive accountable. I do think, on the other hand, though, the Democrats are not being fair actors here. They are not willing to take any positive action on the border wall. They're not willing to take any action in terms of trying to fix the problems that we have with our immigration system more broadly, and are trying to embarrass the president. So there's a lot of different things going on, but ultimately, I do think that the two different branches of government providing checks on each other is a very good thing more broadly for our republic.
Which, of course, is how the Constitution was designed, so we would have these checks and balances. But in other areas, Noah, Congress seems to be more than willing to give up its power and authority. And I'm thinking particularly of health care, of environmental regulations, where Congress gives the deep state, the executive bureaucracy, a broad mandate and says, okay, you figure out the details, you write the rules. Is there any effort by Congress to claw some of that back, or are they more than happy to let the executive take care of those fine details?
I think that there are a bunch of areas that Congress is looking to try and claw back some of the authority. There's a number of different bills out there. For example, Mike Lee's big champion of one that would require congressional approval on any, you know, regulation over estimated to be impact over $100 million over the course of the regulation's life, for example. I think there's a lot of other things we need to do in terms of scaling back a Chevron deference, which is the Supreme Court's presumption that what agencies are doing is legal and constitutional. And so I think that is an area that I think Supreme Court provided a check to, you know, to the deep state. But ultimately, what's going on and what the Trump administration has done is he has actually assembled a very aggressive cabinet that is working regulation by regulation to undo the regulatory state in Washington, D.C. And, you know, by some estimates, they have repealed close to 30 regulations for every new regulation they're putting in place. This is far more than President Trump's promise to repeal two for every one that he put in place. And so by doing such a good job of rolling back these regulations, it is taking away different tools that the deep state has to enact harm on America's businesses, to negatively impact individuals. I mean, these regulations are serious stuff. These are laws that are passed without congressional or other political oversight. They conduct these public comment hearings behind closed doors. They go out of their way to make sure no one outside of whatever particular industry knows about it. So, you know, I think that there's an awful lot that Trump's doing to try and scale all of that back. And he's being very effective at it. It's one of the things that it's not very cool to talk about because it's boring. It's regulations, but the majority of rules and regulations that govern businesses are not done through the legislature. They're done through the bureaucracy. And that's what Trump has been very successful in undoing, because it doesn't require an inactive Congress to do. He has the ability to go through and actually have his agency heads work on that.
So in some ways, the president is doing more to restore the powers of the legislative branch than what they're doing on their own, which is...
No, absolutely, which is not surprising. I mean, Congress loves, they love to talk, but they don't really love to legislate anymore. And it's almost impossible to get a good bill out of Congress. But Trump's a man of action. That's why the American people elected him.
That is indeed true. We have been talking with Noah Wall, who is Vice President of Advocacy at Freedom Works. Noah, tell us a little bit about Freedom Works and where folks can go online to learn more.
Freedom Works is a nonprofit advocacy group that works to advance personal freedom, individual liberty, and the rule of law. And for any of your listeners who'd like to join us, they're welcome to go to our website, freedomworks.org. That's freedomworks.org. We make signing up really easy, and we hope that we can get your listeners involved.
Noah Wall of Freedom Works. Noah, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth. This week, we're not going to talk about politics. We're going to talk about policy, because a couple of major items on the agenda here. Scott, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk, first of all, about the federal budget and, Scott, that process underway, supposedly to culminate in a budget around the 1st of October. We know that won't happen. But the whole issue of spending caps is becoming ever more urgent. Can you explain to us where we stand on the spending limits that Congress has?
First of all, your listeners need to be certainly aware of the fact that we are in the middle of a $1 trillion deficit for the current fiscal year. This is because Congress has been irresponsible with the level of discretionary spending and also the debt and deficit drivers, which are Social Security and Medicare. So we're in the middle of this big deficit, and there's no end in sight. And what's Congress about to do? They're about to increase spending by another $300 billion. Here's why. In 2011, the Congress was in divided government underneath President Obama. House Republicans had just taken over the majority for the first time in a long time, and Democrats with Harry Reid controlled the Senate. They engaged in a major negotiation to try to have some fiscal discipline following the Great Recession and the gigantic stimulus legislation that Obama put through. And what resulted were these budget spending caps that were created into statute to help Congress limit spending. Well, every 2 years, they've circumvented the spending caps by increasing spending. Sometimes they paid for part of it, sometimes they paid for all of it, and now they're not paying for any of it, and that's why we have bigger deficits in the end. Right now, the president has given McConnell and the Senate the ability to begin negotiations with Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats, but the White House is overseeing those discussions to make sure that they don't go off the rails. The White House's official position is that we do not need a new spending deal and that the budget caps that were passed into law are fine and they can meet the needs of the military through what's called overseas contingency operations. So basically, if you don't have an agreement, you'll see a big cut in spending off the current levels, which is them superseding the spending caps repeatedly. So this is a real big issue because, on one hand, the president is trying to allow for Congress to do its constitutional responsibility with appropriations and spending, and what remains to be seen is whether or not he will sign a bill into law. And this is, I think, the timing of the negotiation is between now and the end of the summer, and I think you'll see a deal cut and passed by the end of September, the end of the fiscal year.
In terms of the debt limit that we have, Scott, is there any discussion on what's going to happen with that? Because are we not, as a country, set to hit that debt limit at some point over the next couple of months?
The debt limit did expire already, and I think that happened on March 1st. So what Treasury is incurring right now is called extraordinary measures, and it's when they sell off certain assets to avoid a default on the debt limit. And I think a new debt limit increase or a suspension of the debt limit to a date certain will be a part of this budget cap negotiation. So you'll also probably see emergency disaster spending relief for states that have incurred natural disasters. And I think we'll see some of that all combined into a big, ugly deal that just really exacerbates the issue on spending.
Let's now talk for a couple of minutes about trade. The Trump administration is working diligently to try to bring to a conclusion a new U.S., Mexico, and Canada trade agreement to replace NAFTA. Where do those talks stand, and what are the issues that are currently being resolved?
The main issue here is that Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats will act on the trade agreement first, and what they're trying to extract from the administration is stronger labor protections, which basically means that they want to make sure that there isn't competitive forces in labor, and they want to protect special interests in big labor. That's obviously concerning, but the president needs to get this agreement forward through the Congress and make sure that it passes. I think that they are really on the verge of spending a lot of their resources with the White House and the way that we have divided government in the House and Senate to try to get the USMCA through and signed into law. What remains to be seen is, does Nancy Pelosi get some extractions on
the labor issues, and then does she move the goalposts and allow Trump to have a big victory heading into 2020?
What happens if the House and Senate are not able, and the White House are not able, to resolve their differences and no new agreement is put into place?
Well, you make a good point there. I think that the Democrats understand that no trade deal is worse than a trade deal that Trump wants. So I think that that's what the pressure on the Democrats is to make sure that there's not a lack of any trade agreement between Canada and Mexico.
We have Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on all of them for us. Scott, tell us a bit about the Club for Growth.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital, and we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, including all 50 states. And if your listeners are interested, they can check us out on our website, www.clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The Social Security Trust Fund will become insolvent in 16 years unless significant changes are made, and made soon. To learn more, we have this report from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
If you're like me, if you're a 32-year-old who has never really harbored much in the way of expectations that you would receive benefits from Social Security, then, well, this week's news from the Social Security Trust Fund probably didn't unsettle you all that much, although it was another sign of the coming fiscal reckoning that our country will have to deal with. But actually, the news is pretty significant, and really far more significant if you're, say, 50 years old right now, or for that matter, if you've just freshly retired and you're looking ahead to a decade or two of Social Security benefits as you live out your retirement age, take vacations, do whatever it is you plan on doing now that your work life is behind you. Because it turns out that Social Security, according to the Trust Fund report released this week, is going to be insolvent in just 16 years. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at this new report, a report issued on Monday by the trustees of Social Security and Medicare that say both of these old age entitlement programs are in serious trouble of not being able to meet their obligations unless some significant policy changes are made, and made soon. Social Security will be insolvent and unable to pay the full value of promised benefits by 2035. That's actually 1 year later than the same report said last year. But even so, that's just 16 years in the future. And Social Security's costs will exceed its income as soon as 2020, which means the program will dip into the red and start pulling out of the trust fund. All of that, again, according to a new report published Monday by Social Security's trustees. At the end of 2018, Social Security was providing income for about 67 million Americans. About 47 million of them were over age 65, and the majority of the rest were disabled. If nothing changes, the Social Security Trust Fund will be fully depleted by 2035, and the program would then have to impose across-the-board cuts of 20% on all beneficiaries. Now, that may sound like it's a long way off. I have a hard time even now thinking about the fact that next year is already 2020. It seems like that's the distant future. But the reality is that 2035 is really not that far away. If you're a 51-year-old worker today, you will just be hitting retirement age when those cuts kick in. And by the time we hit the point of insolvency for Social Security, some parts of Medicare, that's the program that pays for health care services for the elderly, some parts of Medicare will already be unable to cover the full cost of their benefits. The trustees report released Monday says that the fund for Medicare Part A, which covers hospital and nursing home costs, will be depleted by 2026, just 7 years from now. Medicare Part B, which covers routine medical care like visits to the doctor, and Medicare Part D, which covers prescription drugs, they are at least on more solid footing and as far as we can tell right now, will remain solvent indefinitely. Now, it's important to remember that insolvency is not the same as bankruptcy. So by 2026 and 2035, respectively, Medicare and Social Security will not have enough money to pay the full cost of their obligations. That's what insolvent means. That's not the same as saying they'll have no money at all. So you'll face benefit cuts, but you'll still get something under current policies. It's also important to keep in mind that these projections are constantly shifting, and they're based on economic data, demographic trends, and actuarial projections. Last year, Social Security was supposed to hit insolvency by 2034, and the year before, the trustees said it wouldn't happen until 2037. So it's something of a moving target, But time keeps on slipping, and ignoring this looming crisis is not going to make it go away. Still, I'm hopeful at least that Congress could be spurred to action by the threat that Social Security will start posting losses in just 2 years, because that's an important tipping point. The last time that happened, the last time Social Security ran into the red, was back in 1982, and that provided an impetus for federal policymakers to make several changes, including an increase to the payroll tax, that kept the federal old age pension program solvent for a few more decades. Without policy changes this time around, the new report shows that Social Security will start losing money in 2020 and will continue to operate in the red effectively as far into the future as we are capable of projecting right now. It will never come back into the black. Right now, there's not much evidence that federal policymakers are ready to face that challenge. In fact, there's hardly any at all. President Donald Trump has repeatedly promised not to touch Social Security while he's in office, even though some changes are almost certainly needed to keep the program running. Democrats in Congress, meanwhile, they are eyeing Medicare for All proposals that will likely pile literally billions of new obligations onto a federal entitlement program that's already struggling to remain solvent under its own weight. What's really needed is a complete reconsidering of the relationship between older Americans and these entitlement programs. I realize it's easy for me to say as someone who's still only in their early 30s, but both Social Security and Medicare were really designed for an entirely different workforce and population when they were implemented more than a half century ago. Social Security launched back in 1935 when the average life expectancy for Americans was 61. That means the average person died 4 years before they qualified for any Social Security benefits. So it's not as if everyone was collecting Social Security. It was really only for people who had outlived their means. Meanwhile, demographics are really blowing up the basic premise that Social Security was based on. There are right now about 2.8 workers for every Social Security recipient. That's down from 3.5 in the middle of the last decade, and it's way down from 5 workers per beneficiary back in 1960. That's the kind of relationship you need to keep these programs running. Today, Social Security and Medicare function mostly as just a giant conveyor belt that transfers wealth from the young and relatively poor to the old and relatively rich, allowing the average person who now lives to be 78 more than a decade of taxpayer-funded retirement, and that's not the way these programs were set up. Indeed, if that's what we intend these programs to do, then they should be restructured to have a funding mechanism that allows for that equation to make sense. The important thing right now is for Congress and for policymakers and for people, really, for the general public, to recognize that this is a debate we are going to have whether we want to or not, and that the further we put it off, the more difficult and ultimately really more painful it's going to be for people who have to live through the inevitable cuts that are coming down the pike if nothing is done. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of Social Security and entitlements and the national debt and all of that at Reason.com. You can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
College and university students are piling up massive debt as they work toward their degrees. That is because higher education is following a failed business model. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Exploding student debt is fueling a debate in Congress and in the public about free public education for colleges. The National Education Association is even pushing for free college education. The legacy of student loans is bringing to the forefront the student loan crisis plaguing our nation, as well as the financial instability of academic institutions in the United States. The multiple and interrelated problems for universities are the student loan crisis, declining student enrollment, as well as the continuing increase of tuition and fees at academic institutions, will combine to trigger a major retrenchment in educational institutions in our country. Relative to the student loan crisis, the New York Federal Reserve concluded in its 2018 report that the obligations for student loans total approximately $1.5 trillion, or approximately $37,000 per student for the class of 2016. The report notes that there are over 16.8 million borrowers under the age of 30, while the total number of borrowers is almost 44,700,000. The delinquency rates on the loans ranges between 10 to 20% for the various age categories, and the number of borrowers and the delinquency rates have skyrocketed since 2012. Surprisingly, the report also indicates that there are 3.2 million borrowers over the age of 60 with an average balance of $26,700. The delinquency rate for those borrowers is approximately 12%. Concurrent with the higher student loan balances, college enrollment rates for students have declined 2.3% in 2013 compared to 2012, while the decline in enrollment was 1.7% from 2018 compared to 2017, continuing a trend that has continued for 6 years now. There are many factors which have contributed to the decline in college enrollment. However, major factors include rapidly increasing tuitions, lower birth rates of all things, higher unemployment rates for recent graduates, and the debilitating effects of student loan repayments on students and their parents. The 21st century is the first time in our nation's history in which the parents have had student loan debts and obligations and now have children considering entering college. The experiences of those parents as well as the debt obligations themselves have discouraged their children from incurring too much debt. Additionally, despite the declines in enrollment, tuition increases for the period 2017 and 2018 averaged 1.9% over the prior year for private institutions and 1.3% for public institutions. These increases have outpaced increases in income for the families supporting students, as well as for the students themselves in the job market post-graduation. The net result is that the affordability index for college, meaning the ability to pay relative to income and funds available for education, is widening and making colleges relatively more expensive than they were decades ago. You would think that that would all bode well for free college education, but you must be aware of the other side of the story. Concurrently, Moody's 2019 report gave a negative financial outlook for all universities. Earlier studies have indicated that over 50% of all colleges and universities are projected to close, merge, or shut down in the next 50 years. The consolidation, failure, and decline have already started, and their pace will accelerate. Obviously, schools that are well-funded and well-endowed will be little affected by those changes. However, marginally profitable schools or schools with high debt loads, which depend upon taxpayer support, will find survival difficult at best, as well they should. That's the free market system. The economic realignment of education will occur due to these factors above, such that the following will take place in the next 5 to 10 years. First, to stem decline in enrollment, tuition has to decrease. Students and schools will struggle to maintain enrollment, and in order to cover their fixed costs, will be forced to reduce tuitions to encourage students and enrollment or risk failure of the university. Second, the faculty tenure system and the burgeoning cost of academic institution will come under question and has to be changed. While existing tenured faculty will probably not be affected, the probability of getting tenure for other professors will be significantly more difficult to accept, with the exception of at well-funded institutions. There's even a possibility that pay for professors will decline. Third, the entire educational systems will begin to file bankruptcy. For the years 2016 to 2017, 120 colleges and universities closed or were forced to merge. Fourth, it's very obvious that academia will be forced to justify its cost relative to the value garnered from the education. This will be one of the first times in history that the value of the education relative to the cost is going to come under scrutiny, as well it should. The education bubble has burst. Free college is not the answer. Reinventing the university system is the answer and is critical to survival. Parents and students alike are demanding accountability and results. It's relevance that is needed, not free college. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KFRH-AM and KBET-AM in Las Vegas, Nevada, along with KRCK-FM in Palm Springs, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.